Chapter 13, A Carnival in the Holy City. On Mount Zion, a hill beyond the southern wall of the old city, you can visit the Coenaculum, where Jesus is said to have had the Last Supper with his disciples, and the Tomb of David, a dark, cave-like place with an array of crowns on a shelf and a scraggly-bearded, bleary-eyed rabbi. But nearby is the memorial to the Jews killed in the Holocaust, where you can see cyanide pellets from the gas chambers, charred remains of Torah scrolls, bloodied and tattered Star of David flags from the Polish ghettos, and soap made from the fat of Jewish bodies. You can stand in the dim light and stare unbelieving. Jewish schoolchildren are herded past, a guide whispering urgently at them. You look at the names, thousands of them on marble panels. Only names now, all of them dead because they were in the way. Germany had to be cleaned up, rid of this unmanageable race. You go out into the sunshine where there is a monument to the children of Poland who were exterminated. Other children stand there now, children of survivors of the purge, some of them, and look at the text about Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted. The thing happened. It happened in our lifetime. We tell ourselves that it could not happen again, but we know in our hearts that it could, though we have no way of predicting who the next victims might be. And you go down from Mount Zion with the freshened memory of anguish, and you look over the city and are glad that the people who endured such unthinkable suffering have at last found a city that is their home. On October 26th, I witnessed the unrivaled joy of these people. It was Simchat Torah, the happiest of Jewish holy days, when the reading of the books of the law is completed for the year in the synagogue and Genesis is begun over again. I went to the Wailing Wall in the morning and found there the same throngs of black-clad Jews that I had seen before, bobbing and chanting in front of the stones. But here also were wildly shouting groups of men, well over 1,000 of them, parading the huge parchment scrolls which had been brought forth from their synagogues. They put their hands on one another's shoulders and danced in a circle, shouting the praises of the book, singing songs about the rebuilding of the temple and the redemption of Jerusalem. Frequently I caught the words Yerushalayim, Israel, Simchat, which I learned means happy, and Adonai, the substitute for the ineffable name of God. At the foot of the wall, groups of men gathered with a prayer shawl held above them like a roof. Although the crowd was made up almost entirely of Jews, one after another told me he knew no more about what was happening than I did, and that I would have to ask a rabbi. I learned at last that this was for the blessing of the scrolls. They would bring their scrolls. Some were covered with large, elaborately filigreed silver cylinders, others with embroidered velvet sheaths, some topped by gold or silver crowns, and begin their own dance, weaving and circling among the others, eyes closed or lifted to heaven, bodies jerking and swaying with ecstasy, voices raised in lusty hymns. There were several Oriental Jewish women sitting on a pile of rubble at one side, keening in the piercing Arab ululation of joy or sorrow. When the men drew near with the scroll, these women rocked with ecstasy, throwing kisses towards the sacred book, with tears streaming down their dark cheeks. Now and then I caught the word Alleluia from their shrieks. The dancing men paused at intervals to embrace the scrolls, to kiss them and clasp them in their arms, lifting them high as a young and strong lover might do with the woman he loved, while the other men increased their shouts and some of them waved flags. There were children riding on the shoulders of their fathers, laughing with the excitement of it all, bouncing high and victorious above the crowd. Not much emphasis was ever placed on plain human happiness in my religious training. Our gatherings were careful and quiet and controlled. The joy of the Lord was to us a deep, serious thing, not connected with celebrating in any way, let alone with dancing, and to find myself confronted with this wild abandon and told that it was the celebration of the written word gave me pause. Deuteronomy 12 speaks of the Jews living in the land which God gives them, destroying the places of worship belonging to strange deities and making sacrifices to the Lord God. Happy before the Lord in all your undertakings. Clearly, the Jews had something here that the rest of us had missed. Arabs did not quite know what to make of the uninhibited display of happiness at all times and places. They have turned our holy city into a carnival, complained one. In the evening, I went to the Jaffa Gate, the western entrance to the Old Jerusalem, where I understood there was to be another celebration. The entire city, it appeared, was there, thronging the area outside the gate and backed up for many blocks. The papers reported crowds of 250,000 to 500,000. Floodlights played on them from the top of the crenellated walls. There was talk of the possibility of Arab terrorists throwing a bomb. Two wooden platforms had been set up in front of the citadel, a fortress built on the foundation of Herod's Faisal Tower, brilliantly lighted and decked with flags. A band was playing and police horses were prancing. The program had been hastily put together and left much to be desired, probably even for those who understood Hebrew, but it was colorful. And between the long speeches delivered in pontifical tone, there was dancing by the various ethnic groups, the most interesting being the Yemeni Jews, in their brightly striped robes and turbans, doing a wild dance. There was more parading of scrolls, some by men in business suits and black fedoras, some by men in oriental robes, and much clapping, shouting, singing, and stamping around in circles. The band did its best to keep up with the changes in the program. It did not sound as though it had much time for rehearsal, and the drums thumped, the trumpets screeched, and the accordions wheezed more or less ad-lib, but who was listening? The crowd was far too vast and the public address system too weak to allow many to hear or see what was going on. What did it matter anyway? Most of them were not religious. They had come simply to be a part of this great, wild, frenzied, liberated joy. For not only was this the happiest of holy days, but it was the first Simchat Torah ever celebrated at the gates of the old city by many of those present. And it was the climax of a year of miraculous victories. There were children on the program too, and their dancing was with utter abandon, faster and faster and faster, as the earnestly toiling band pounded and blew and squeezed to keep up with them. Then the men danced again, prancing and strutting, waving arms and handkerchiefs above their heads, trotting around in circles with the precious scrolls clutched in their arms, hats bobbing, feet clumping. It was only the hats that were visible to the majority. Fur hats, turbans, fedoras, skull caps, even an opera hat or two appeared and disappeared from the moving mass. TV cameramen leaped around in front of them, pushed their massive equipment about so that at times very little else was visible to the audience, and generally made themselves a nuisance. For after all, to them, the audience was in the United States or England and numbered in the millions. What did it matter that Israel should be barred from seeing the show? At one point, a Yemeni Jew stood up to the microphone with a book in his hand and sang in a stentorian voice a long, wavering chant of perhaps three or four tones, then handed the book to another who sang his own sort of song. This went on until a British gentleman in a top hat and tails, introduced as Sir Somebody, was given the honor of adding the last letter to a new copy of the Torah. And then the band struck up, together this time, the song which has swept all of Israel since the war, Jerusalem of Gold. When they came to the chorus, the entire throng gradually took up the refrain until it swelled to a thunder, Yerushalayim. Everyone had expected dancing in the streets after the program, but the mounted police dispersed them as soon as the singing finished. I went then through the dark streets from the Jaffa Gate to the Wailing Wall, where there was more dancing and praying. One handsome young Jew had an hourglass-shaped Arab drum on which he began a vigorous and powerful thumping with his fingertips, holding it under his left arm. The faces of the young men and women lit up. Their feet began to move quickly, and soon they were all whirling and swinging in the cold night air. The stars above them, the ruined Arab houses behind them, and no sound except the hard, strong rhythm of the drum and the soft thudding of their feet on the packed earth. I felt as if a huge door had suddenly been flung open where I had not even known a door existed. Here was a revelation of joy, and it was Jewish joy, the wild, wholehearted welcome of a people for the written word. The word, Hebrew characters on parchment, lovingly copied, carefully preserved, beautifully displayed, had been the center of their dancing, the subject of their songs. Their God had given himself to them first at Sinai, in the tables of the law, quote, "Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln. And the whole mountain quaked greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder." At a Jewish party where I had asked why the Jews did not drink and alcoholism is virtually unknown in Israel, a hot argument ensued, and one man pointed out that it would make more sense to inquire why others did. "Alcoholism," he said, "is an aberration. Why, for example, are the English such inveterate gin drinkers? Because of the weather, obviously. If you had London fog and drizzle and cold, you'd drink too. But we have smoke on the mountain. We have Jerusalem. Who needs liquor?" It was a pretty good answer. The word, the God who gave it, and the city where his temple was, these people had learned to love. Being human, their love was not constant and their lives often selfish, but they knew themselves to be in possession of a prize. Quote, "Great peace have they who love thy law, and nothing can make them stumble." The same psalmist who wrote the litany of love to the word, Psalm 119, wrote also, "I look at the faithless with disgust because they do not keep thy commands." The reader of the Old Testament cannot escape the pride of these Hebrews in their position, the towering scorn they feel for all outside the pale. But then there were not many in Israel to whom all this talk of the word meant anything. I had to keep reminding myself of this, and it was easy to read too much into what I saw, for I kept wanting to see them as God's people, the chosen, the Israel for whom the promises were made. There was not much more meaning for many of them in the celebration of Simchat Torah than there is for the majority in Christian lands in the celebration of Christmas, which is to commemorate the manifestation of the same word in another form, that of flesh instead of spirit. But if they are a thoughtful, reflective people, even if they reject religious claims, they must surely gain, through the observation of this holy day, some clearer consciousness of what it means to be a Jew. I certainly learned, as I had never learned before, what it means not to be one. It is possible, of course, to take a view of such tolerant bonhomie of all peoples on the earth that one easily shoulders his way into any group and sees himself as one of them. "Why, I didn't feel any distinctions," or "they took me right in," are common expressions. The Israelis who invited me into their homes could not possibly have been kinder. But I knew, from long training in the Bible, what the Jews meant in God's economy. And whether or not I ought to have felt excluded, whether or not the majority of Jews accepted the biblical definition, had nothing to do with the effect this celebration of Simchat Torah had upon me. I saw myself as not chosen? The answers the theologians would give me, and I knew exactly what they were, the arguments about whether these people really were Jews, the many possible interpretations of the scene and of my feelings about it only served to complicate everything. There was no getting around it. These people unsettled me. They had unsettled a lot of other people in other times and places, for other reasons, perhaps, but the mystery of Israel is a real mystery, one with which the world is bound to have to cope. And we may as well believe that Zechariah's vision was prophetically true when he wrote, "In those days, 10 men from the nations of every tongue shall take hold of the robe of a Jew, saying, 'Let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.'" There are serious-minded Jews in the world today who question whether or not Israel is faithful to her role. Samuel H. Dresner wrote in the Jewish Quarterly, Volume 14, Number 3, quote, "The world has questions to ask, and Israel has answers to give. But what will happen if, when the world, in fear and trembling, puts its terrible questions to Israel, we have nothing to say? What if we stutter and stammer with the shame of ignorance written on our faces? What if the world looks into our minds and asks us who Isaiah was, or what the Baal Shem Tov taught, or why Rabbi Akiva smiled as the Romans burned him, in an attempt to explore the palaces of wisdom, compassion, justice they have been told these men built, so that their own poverty might be enriched? And we are unable to answer.